Welcome to the Speakeasy with Kate Wand, a safe space to discuss liberal ideas.
I had a conversation with Barry Brownstein, Professor Emeritus of Economics and Leadership at the University of Baltimore. Barry is also the author of The Inner Work of Leadership, as well as a blog called Mindset Shifts, which you can find on Substack. He focuses on the psychological and spiritual solutions, advocating individual inner work as the antidote to ever-growing authoritarianism. His work has been very inspirational, and you can find multiple cinematic-style films based on his essays at AIER. You know, because we've done now about five films on your different essays so far, because they're really incredible. You find a way to tap into the nerve of exactly what's going on socially and spiritually. And one thing that I notice is that you're very solutions oriented, and you're very much, it seems like, a peacemaker. Like, you talk about the I-it model versus the I-thou model. So seeing others as we see ourselves and really trying to find the common humanity. And this seems to be an underlying theme that you propose as a solution to the times that we're living
in. This is the biggest problem in the world that right now that people are having increasingly seeing the common humanity in others. We see others as objects. And, you know, we can think about it on the more, you know, macro level. You know, we could think about it as other countries, as we were just, you know, talking about it, how we see China, how we see Russia, and other countries. But we could see it on the more individual, you know, plane also, you know. We could see as we go through our daily life how we treat others as objects. You know, we're at the supermarket and we get impatient. We find ourselves with these impatient thoughts because the cashier is moving a little bit too slowly for us. We think she should be or he should be, you know, moving faster. And we start treating, in our own mind, we start treating people as objects. We don't see the humanity in people. And that builds from there, how we go about our lives each day, how we think we have to call customer service, for instance. And are we joining with the customer service agent in solving a problem? Or are we mad at the customer service agent even before he or she gets on the phone because of the problem that we don't feel like, you know, that should have come our way? Well, problems come people's way every day. There's no escaping problems. We're always going to have problems. So treating people as objects, the I-it, as you said, treating people as it's just, you know, permeates our thinking, and then it builds up. So now it's easy to see people who have made different medical decisions than other people as it's. Well, how dare they not do the same thing I have done? You know, I know what's right. You know, it should be done my way. And so this kind of tribal thinking, you know, starts in everyday encounters and then builds up into issues inside a country and then builds up outside the country, how we see other countries, how we see people in other countries. And wow, history says, and you've brought this out too, and well, your work too. History says this ends badly. This is something for us to be aware now of our mindset before it's too late. You know, every time I write an essay and it's about COVID, I get, you know, predictably, I get a couple of the same comments. Wrong, with an exclamation point. This is a medical issue. This is, none of the issues that you are talking about are relevant. Wrong, you know, and they get angry. They don't refute anything I have to say, it's just wrong. This is a health issue. This is a public health issue. It's none of these other things. And how dare you bring in these other issues? Yeah. Well, how dare I? I have to, because there's commonalities in the mindsets I see. And if you people don't, you wake up and start to see the commonalities in the mindset, you know, we are all in big trouble. We're going down a slippery slope over here.
Yes.
So
now, yeah, I also think that what's interesting is people might ask the question, how does this fit in with economics and in you know, becoming somebody whose maybe civic duty it is to learn about economics? You talked about that in one of your recent pieces, mm-hmm. Where you're talking about Mises and his book, Bureaucracy, mm-hmm. right?
That's
where
right.
He says it's your civic duty to know about economics, and you compare that with understanding some of the scientific issues with what we're dealing with right now, saying yeah. we have an obligation to understand it, or at least if we're not going to understand it, then we need to just kind of like observe, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. our social order and our economic order are inextricably linked.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, people, I call it NPR syndrome, where, you know, people, you could call it CNN syndrome too, you know, people sit all day long. They have NPR on in the background or CNN. And they mm-hmm. just adopt the canned opinions that they've heard. You know, they know nothing about the issue. Now, I'm fine. You know, I'm fine with, you know, somebody thinking, I don't have the time to, you know, to learn and, you know, study this. I'm just going to follow I'm going to get with the program, as, you know, people say. But then that's fine. But then just the don't get in everybody else's face about your choice to get with the program. You know, if you're yes. going to adopt NPR syndrome and just have a canned opinion, well, you have forfeited your right to tell anybody else what to do. Well, you never have a right to tell anybody else what to do. But certainly it's especially obnoxious that you try and tell anybody what to do when you have not studied the issue on your own at all. You've made no attempt to study the issue. Now, right. there's enough information out there. There's enough people who are providing alternative views for you, at least to consider in easy to understand bites. I mean, your films are 15 minutes long and they're easy to follow, and other people are yeah. doing similar work. And, you know, people can get other information that will cause them to at least think, well, perhaps I'm not seeing the whole picture over here. Perhaps there's more I have to learn. There's more I have to study. And what happens is that as you open up one door, other doors start to open up. You start to have your eyes open to things you never saw before. It's like yes. if you're going to paint your house, all of a sudden you start noticing the colors of other people's homes, whereas you didn't, right? You didn't see it before. And now all of a sudden you're seeing other people's homes.
Yes.
So their color. So it's yes. kind of like as you go down this path, you get the understanding that you need is out there. There are people who are eager to help you, start to make sense of the world. And it's something, yes, I agree with what you said. It is a civic, duty to at least, if you're not going to do that, to just keep your mouth shut, at least. You know, don't make other people feel bad for their choices. Don't shun them. Don't insult them. Don't act like they're an it, like we were just, talking about. Don't act like they're an object. You have no right to make people into an object for having an opinion other than your own. And then to further to try and censor them. That's just terrible.
I think also one thing that we're seeing here is that with the increased use of masks, people have that anonymity shield where they can hide behind it, but they also can view the other as an it, because it's really much harder to communicate with somebody when you can't see their face. And so therefore you have these kinds of interactions which now have become less human-like in their quality. Mm-hmm. So I think that that also exacerbates the social situation. And you've seen a bunch of behavior unleashed in the last 2 years or so that's very antisocial, and which you may have not seen quite so often before.
Yeah, and absolutely. The masks are a great point. And also the people think they could say things online, social, that they can't say face to face. They just say, terrible things to people. But the interesting thing, we had talked about this previously, about the whole idea of people are just, projecting what's going on inside themselves. They're trying to get rid of their psychological trash. They are trying to accuse people, for instance, of being irresponsible because of the fact they know they're irresponsible. What is the most irresponsible thing that you can do? Is it just follow a canned opinion or to do what other people tell you to do? That is very irresponsible. And then these people who just say the science is settled because Fauci said so, what is more irresponsible than that? So, of course, they feel shamed about the fact that they're being irresponsible. So they try and make everybody else as the irresponsible person, and they call them names. That's, called, if it's a simple psychological understanding where we are trying to get our, psychological trash that's inside of us and dump it onto other people. Projection. And that is a problem. That's growing too. That is, growing too, where your people, your pressure internally, if you don't look at your trash, just starts to build up. It starts to build up and you are interested in dumping it, throwing it out. Now, that's why also there's a increase in addictive behavior that's, come with COVID too. Because here's why. I'll trace it out for you, okay? As people are going against what is in their best nature, okay, if you're constantly attacking other people, you are going against your best nature, okay? There's that, even if you're not conscious of that, there's shame and guilt that's, building up inside of you.
Yes.
Because it's contrary to who you are as a person, right? So the more you call people names and stuff, the more you think badly of other people, well, you have to get rid of it. So you seek, relief. You seek, relief with whatever it is. There's, drugs.
Escapism.
Alcohol, sex, whatever it is, you seek, and shopping, sitting and watching CNN all day. People can't be with themselves because of what's going on. And this is increasingly the case. I used to assign an interesting exercise to leadership students. And it was go home, sit in a chair with no phone, no book, no gadget, nothing on. Just sit in the chair for 15 minutes and come back and share how it went. So now that seems like a trivial exercise. What do you mean? Sit in a chair for 15 minutes, don't do anything, don't talk to anybody, don't have any books, nothing. Some people came in the next week and said, wow, that was the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. Sit in a chair for 15 minutes with themselves because the internal noise, the internal chatter,
Yes.
Was all of a sudden coming front and center.
Right.
And they didn't like it. Yeah, they've always done everything they can to drown out that noise, you know, through their constant, you know, checking the phone, for instance. Average person, you know, checks their phone, I think it's 150 times a day. So there's all this addictive behavior that they engage in to kind of drown out the internal chatter. But people, if they're going to stop, you know, projecting, they have to become more aware of the internal chatter. In order to get to the light, you have to first go through the, you know, darkness, so to speak. And it's not a bad process, because the internal, you know, chatter, the internal noise is not who you are. And it's very loud and very raucous, very, seems scary, but it's not scary at all. It's just, you know, kind of nonsense. If you start to get hip to the noise in your head, you see it's a lot of fragmented thoughts, a lot of thoughts about the past, future scenarios, all this and all that. And it's really shouldn't be that scared to look at it. And the more you look at it, the less you have to, you know, project, the less you have to see people as it's, and the more harmony there is in, you know, society, the more social love cooperation there is, the more, you know, goodness there is. So,
so talking about projection and kind of leaving, you know, by trying to take your psychological garbage and just give it to other people, you just end up with a bigger pile of garbage, essentially.
Yeah, absolutely. Because the idea that you're trying to get rid of, it's in your mind. It's not in them. So, for instance, the most common example is somebody gets angry in traffic. Yeah. And they're so incensed by what somebody else, you know, did on the road. Well, you know, that other person didn't make them angry. They had anger that was pre-existing in them already. Otherwise, they were not going to get triggered by it. So the other person on the road didn't do it to them. They had the anger in them already. So their job is to, well, look at the anger. And I bet you the person who gets angry on the road all the time would find that there's other times in the day they're getting angry. They're getting angry over very trivial things. Perhaps it's a problem in their household. Perhaps it's interfering with their work. You know, even if you're not expressing your anger, if you're thinking angry thoughts, your people can see through you. You know, you're not fooling anybody. You know, projection, you know, I mean, so the cool thing is about this work, the more you own your own garbage, it improves your own life too. It's not that it's just improving the lives of other people around you, which it is. And also, it's not just that it's cutting down in the yard 5 years from now a war, you know, because we're, you know, projecting against China as a, you know, collective bunch, as a, you know, society, but we're improving our own lives. So, and there's a lot of advantages to this. And so people don't tend to see it. They don't see they could be improving their own lives as they, you know, go about their business. They're too enamored with the thinking in their head. They don't have the, you know, capacity to separate themselves out from their thinking. And exercise I would sometimes assign students, you know, that is leadership students, not economic students, by the way. I should make that clear.
But, economic student guinea pigs.
No, it's a leadership student. So I would ask them if they were interested in seeing their own thinking more, to just imagine themselves as a character on the stage and just see themselves going around about their, you know, gyrations. And the fact they can be aware of the character shows them that they're not there thinking, right? You know, something that you can be aware of must not be who you actually are. It just must be something, some, you know, temporary madness that you've adopted. And, you know, this can change and for great benefit, you know, to you also as a person. So even though in my essays, I don't tend to focus on the personal side of it, there is advantages, you know, to the person. It's I tend to focus on the, you know, societal advantages, but there's advantages for the person too.
Of course. Well, society is made up of individuals. And so that all makes sense.
Yeah.
If we have individuals who are you know, self-aware, who are able to move beyond just their thoughts and their feelings, observe their behavior, observe the behavior of others, and just kind of take a stance that approaches life that way, then you don't end up with situations where you have so much disarray.
Yeah.
Social
absolutely.
Disarray.
I mean, your feelings are, you know, anything you're feeling is a guide to the quality of your thinking. It's not a guide to anything else. It's not a guide. Your feelings are not telling you anything about somebody else. They're telling you about how the way you're thinking right now. Mm-hmm. So if you have angry feelings, it's because you have angry thoughts. It's literally impossible to have an angry feeling if you're not having an angry thought. So other people, our interactions with other people are giving us very useful information about what's going on in our own head if we stop, you know, projecting, you see. As long as we're you know, projecting, we're thinking the contents of our feelings is a guide to information about the other person, but it's, you know, really information about ourselves. Okay, now that doesn't mean the other person may not be doing what they're doing. The other driver may have cut you off on the road. Dr. Fauci is certainly, you know, doing the things he's accused of. But you can discern that. You can just see it as a fact, right? You don't have to get angry at a truck that's barreling on the street to not step in front of it. You just discern there's a truck going down at a high speed and you get out of its way. So, and you do what you have to do in order to stop it if it's something that you have to do. But your angry feelings are really telling you something about what's going on in you, not about what's going on in the outside.
Now, this is extremely important self-work to be done at this stage of where we are as a society. It sounds kind of like the Enlightenment values that you're talking about as well, that kind of self-awareness, self-growth, higher knowledge, and all of those things.
Yeah.
But we've found ourselves at a place where we've become increasingly tribal again, and you've written about this as well. And I guess this is what happens when you start to project all of that anger and all of those so-called negative feelings outwards onto the other, onto the it, then you end up in this kind of situation. Right. And so this is where we find ourselves now, correct?
Yeah, you know, this is hard work, as you say. You know, this is not New Age blather, because some New Age, you know, blather is about denying what's going on inside of you and acting like it's all peace and light. Well,
yes,
it is
positive,
it can be all peace and light. Yeah. Right. You know, positive thinking, and anybody who knows, who has ever tried to control your thinking, you can't control your thinking. You know, that's been, you know, proven in countless psychological experiments. You can't control your thinking. The average person thinks about 50,000 thoughts a day. Most of them are, you know, not positive thoughts. They're not
positive thoughts. That makes me feel better. That makes me feel better personally.
That's right. Right. No, right. No, you don't have to worry. We're all in the same boat, because I often ask a group, right? I often ask a group, is there anybody who would be comfortable with an LCD screen on their forehead showing their current thought? And everybody gets the point instantly. There is nobody who would be comfortable having an LCD screen on their forehead, having their current thought, because all of us think a lot of garbage, right? So this is not a new age thing about kind of denying all of this. Mm-hmm. It's about going through the darkness, so to speak, and, you know, finding out that in each person, there's something deeper, something higher than that, some place where we are all, you know, connected. But you don't get there by just saying you're going to get there. You don't get there by singing, you know, Kumbaya and saying, isn't it great that we're all, you know, connected on this deep place? No, you know, get there by seeing the barriers inside of you that are coming up through your thinking that is keeping you from there.
So I think we find ourselves at a place where new age thinking has become kind of like a secular religion, in a sense. Like, it's all about that kind of thinking positive, and it's been happening for a few decades, and it's really a way of escaping your feelings, escaping your thoughts, escaping self-responsibility, and and just pushing feelings down so you don't have to deal with them. And then so you end up with a shallow conformist society as well as a result of that, because nobody is doing the deep digging, you know, or at least many people are not looking that deep, but they think that they've done the work, so they feel enlightened. And that puts you in a trap as well, where you think, well, we can rely on all of these experts. It kind of like leads down that path where we know that there are certain people who know the right way and can lead us there. And you talk about this as well in some of your pieces, one of the recent ones where you talk about gratitude, and you bring up the, you know, the central planning model versus the kind of cosmos model of Hayek. And I'd love for you to get into that a little bit.
Yeah, the whole idea of Hayek's, you know, cosmos is something that, you know, people have a great deal of, you know, trouble with, because it involves something you could never fully grasp. Hayek is clear, you can't fully comprehend the cosmos. So a lot of people get off the train as soon as they find out they're not going to be in charge. You know, they want to be in charge. Of course, I can understand that. I'm rational. I could understand this. I could plan. And of course, Hayek is saying it's impossible, that, you know, society only can create what it creates through the miracle of human, you know, cooperation, if it's not under anybody's, you know, control. And, you know, to go back for just a second to the, you know, previous point, because as you said, there's a lot of new age magical thinking, we could call it, you know, magical thinking. You know, means that, you know, something is going to happen because you think it should happen. You just want it to happen. You're going to, you know, control it to happen. You know, people
manifest.
Think they're in, you know.
That's the word people use, manifest. They'll manifest it into being.
Oh, yeah, that? Right, right, right. Exactly, right, exactly. They think they're going to manifest something. As you can remember, there was this book years ago that was popular called, you know, The Secret. And I think the author was on Oprah and all that stuff, and people were going to manifest all their dreams. Mm-hmm. You know, of course, this is totally absurd. And I mean, it's immediately falsifiable. And but yet, you know, people got caught in up in it, and they're still, you're not caught up in it. And it's a form, as you say, of irresponsibility. They're not taking, you know, responsibility for the work, both the external work and the internal work. And I, also just want to make, this point for a second. The internal work that we're, talking about, it doesn't necessarily involve any type of therapy or analysis or anything like that. It's not that I'm saying you shouldn't do that if you're so drawn, but it's not necessary. It's not necessary because in the course of your daily life, right, your own life is your classroom. Your own life is your therapist, so to speak. Here's why. Because the issues, that are from the past are coming up in the present. It's been, shown that the past is not stored in your brain with some type of computer, your model where you're calling up actual events. Every time you think about something in the past, you are, constructing it again in the present. It's impossible for it to be any other way. And, this has been proven. Now, neuroscientists have, shown this. So you don't have to dig. You don't really have to dig. You just have to be open to seeing what's going on in your own life. Oh, wait, I'm getting upset about this right now. And stop justifying it. Most people immediately when they get upset, their thinking goes to justifying it inside themselves. And then they you try and find allies, somebody in their family or their friend, could you believe what happened? Or could you believe this story? They need an ally.
So
and
true.
That's how, your tribes, start to build up. We have our social media allies, too, where we're in the same, click on Facebook or something. And could you believe this? And all of that justification means we're never going to see what's going on inside ourselves because we're just trying to justify it. We would all rather be right over anything else.
Yes.
We would all rather be right over being happy. We would all rather be right over taking responsibility. We would rather be right. That's the most important thing for a lot of people right now is you're being right. And if you could, and if you can, give up being right for a while, you could kind of sit at the feet of your own life. Your own life could be your own guru and for free. Mm-hmm. You don't have to go to India. You don't have to hire anybody. Your own life is your guru. You can learn a lot from it.
That is absolutely true. I agree with that wholeheartedly. It is very difficult. I wonder why we have the inclination to want to be right first and foremost, and then afterwards have to say, oh, let me step back a little bit and see if I can actually allow myself to be wrong. What do you think it is that makes people want to be right so badly?
Yeah, that is the very great question because it points us back to how badly people want to defend their self-concept. Everybody has a self-concept. We all have these characteristics that we think we are. Part of everybody's self-concept is sadly everybody can tell you their story of victimization. About a time they were, something happened in their life where they were a victim. And if they have an audience, a lot of people like you telling their story. That's why, it's sad sometimes you may have an elderly, relative who's been, telling the same story for the past 30, 40 years about the time they were, victimized. And they love telling the story. I had an aunt, a lovely person, but I said to her once as she was, telling her story for the Yeah. Upteenth time.
Umpteenth.
I said to her, if, you know, telling this story, if she feels better, you know, telling the story. And her answer was, if I didn't tell the story, I wouldn't know who I was. You see?
Wow.
And that was very insightful. Yeah, she was getting at the heart of it. People,
yeah.
You know, she was hip to it. She didn't want to give it up. A lot of people are not hip to what they're doing. They're defending their self-concept. The most important thing, if it's a good self-concept, if they're all puffed up in their self-concept, or if they think, you know, badly of themselves, or, you know, some of each, it's a self-concept.
Yeah.
It's their self-concept that they own, and that's very, you know, kind of a defending that is very important. So a practice you can do is just as you go about the day, just see the times you get defensive. That's hip.
Wow.
That, you know, that's a signal to you that you're defending your self-concept, and there's something for you to learn. You know, this self-concept,
you know,
is I just want to add this. It's, you're constructed entirely of thought. It's not real. It's not a physical thing. It's something you made up, and it's, you're constructed of thought. You could start to unpack it, let it go.
That's wonderful, and it's hopeful, and it's interesting because it reminds me of the series Mad Men that was popular a few years ago, where they have all of these flawed characters, but no one seems to be able to understand their own flaws. And then I think it's the very last episode of the series, the finale, one of the last episodes, somebody says, why is it so easy for other people to tell what's wrong with me or what's wrong with you or what's wrong with them? Why is it so easy for other people to be able to look and say, that's exactly what's wrong with that person. If they just fix that, then everything would be better. And that kind of melts in with the concept of self-concept, because our own self-concept, if it's skewed, which most people's are skewed at some level, you know, you want to get as close to maybe the way that is the most realistic, so to speak, but it's hard to get there, and it takes that work. And I think that that's why it is easier sometimes for other people to point out the flaws in others, because you can see more accurately through objective eyes.
Yeah. 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 I just like to make this clear. We're, you know, describing a process of subtraction, not addition. Okay. We're, you know, subtracting everything that's not really us. And then what's left is us. Now, that may sound very, you know, mystical, but as you start to, you know, practice it, you'll see all of a sudden you'll find yourself acting in a way that you never thought you could act that way. And, you know, like some people find a common example, they have the self-concept that they're shy. And then they start to see, they just have a lot of thoughts about being shy. And there are people who are more outgoing than other people, but they find they're not as shy as they thought. So as soon as they start to see the thinking and let go of the thinking a little bit, naturally, without any effort, they don't have to get themselves pumped up. They don't have to say, okay, I'm going into this social, you know, setting right now, I'm psyched, I'm going to be outgoing today. No, they don't have to, you know, do any of that. As soon as they see their thinking around shyness, they start to automatically act more outgoing, very, you know, naturally, not pumped up or anything. It just comes out easily enough because, you know, they had subtracted the barrier that was in the way. So this is really what we're describing. Subtraction. It's not addition. So you don't have to go out and find something. It's already there. You just have to, you know, remove the varnish, you know, so to speak.
Right. Right. And I love that in your piece where you say how Hayek can transform our ingratitude into gratitude. You talk a little bit about that, how we all have kind of like the little mini central planners inside of all of us, or maybe the mini authoritarians, and we all have exactly. things that we want to control, right? But then you say towards yeah. the end of the piece, when the urge to control arises, we can stand down. The world doesn't depend on our limited understanding, right? And that applies yeah. to your own life as well. So you can just observe, sit back, and let the spontaneous order just take over. And that will organize things kind of on its own.
Right. That there's a, you know, social process for, you know, society. And there's a process also in your own, you know, life too. And you, as you said, we all have this inner central planner. That's a terrible inner central planner. It's as bad as the, you know, societal, you know, central planners. It's just terrible. It's mean. It's nasty. It treats us as an it. You know, if you examine mm-hmm. that whole stream of your thinking, well, you can't examine it all, but just get a glimpse into it. You'll see, you know, throughout the day, that stream of thinking is sometimes calling you names. It isn't only calling other people names, it's calling you a name too. And, you know, this is not a guide to behavior. It's all of its schemes about, you know, maintaining its self-image and about trying to control, I need more of this and less of that. And if I get more of this and less of that, then finally one day I will have arrived. And of course, that is absurd. That is, you know, central planning, you know, thinking. The, you know, each of us has our own, you know, 5-year plan. Our own inner central planner has our own 5-year plan. You know, like you go on the job interview, and the old standard, you know, question was, "How do you see yourself in 5 years?" And of course, that's a terrible question. Because it's like a, you know, real life is to live like going up a darkened, you know, staircase. The, as you step on the second step, then the light goes on the third step. You see the next step in front of you, but you don't see the fourth step until you step on the third step. All of our lives are emergent. It's not, I mean, there's a certain amount of, you know, planning that has to be done, but you have to leave room for emergence, or you're yes. in big trouble in your own life, the same like a, you know, society is in trouble too.
Wow, that is really deep. I like the idea of the staircase. But then I also think if it's a staircase, then it's going in a straight line, which makes me think a central planner may have constructed it. Mm. So I like to good. Think of that.
Yeah. No, that's great. No, that's a really that, you know, you're absolutely right. You know, just as a, you know, society is a couple of steps up of your progress and then sometimes a bit of a step down. Well, you know, so it is with our own life. You know, sometimes it's not just right. a straight line up and, you know, progress with sometimes. But understandings that we gain aren't ever lost. You know, we may, you know, forget temporarily, but they aren't ever lost. They're always, you know, there for us. So the more we're, you know, willing to learn about all different things, the more we're, you know, willing to learn everything we you learn. And I'm not talking about facts right now. I'm talking about understanding about life, understanding about economics and so on. Everything we learn is always there for us. So we just, you know, keep, you know, building on it. But the problem right now in society, there's a lot of people who are unwilling to learn anything right now. And, right. And that's, you know, that goes back to what we were talking about earlier about CNN, you know, syndrome, NPR syndrome. They're not, you know, willing to learn. They just want, you know, canned opinions. And it's, it is scary. Yeah.
One thing that I've noticed as well, and this has been on a personal level, but I'm thinking right now that it also applies to the greater society level, is that some people who tend to be more centroplani than others or more authoritarian than others, seem to have more of that part of their personality ignited, let's say. They tend to want to control things, not that they do understand, but to control things that they don't understand, and to manage the things that they understand the least as a way to maybe manage the chaos, their discomfort, their feelings around not understanding.
Absolutely. You know, that's a form of addiction. You know, we were talking about earlier about addiction, and trying to, you know, control is a form of addiction too. And you could put a lot of energy into that and it doesn't really work. I understand there was a ride in Disneyland called the motorboat ride. And you would get in the boat and the kid would think they're steering the boat, but of course they weren't actually steering the boat. And they didn't realize they weren't steering the boat until they tried to turn left, for instance, and the track was going right and the boat was going to go right anyway. Well, there are strong currents in our lives, and that doesn't mean that there's not some planning in our life that's, you know, called for. Of course there is, but there's a great deal of elements of emergence in our lives where steps we take now open up the door to other steps to emerge in our lives. And people don't have respect for that, tolerance for that. And part of that is why your government is called on by some people to get bigger and bigger to control people's lives, because they don't want any emergence. That's why some people are asking government to do more and more for them.
It's like if they can see the result before the action, if they can see how things are going to turn out and they feel like they have some control over the future, then they're able to maybe quell some anxiety temporarily, right?
Yeah.
And we have a very anxious culture. Yeah. And I think anxiety is also related to inactive potential. And we see a lot of that as well. So do you think that could be contributing to the greater tensions?
Yeah, absolutely. And inauthentic life, which you're trying to control anything, trying to control things, is automatically an inauthentic life. It's going to make you anxious. How could it not be anxious? Because just, think about it. It's a you against the world. How could you not be anxious? The world's going to win. how could you not be... anxious, if you think you're going to be, controlling the world, right?
That is a very good point. And do you think, like, for people who are, at the really high level of government, and these kind of, they have these roles where they really do think that they, by their own hand, can puppeteer life in billions of people, that must be a highly anxious place to function from.
Yeah, it's a very sick place, isn't it? It's a very sick place, that Romania, their, dictator, I think it was 1989, he was overthrown. And you can find this on the YouTube. His last speech, have you ever seen that on the YouTube?
I have not seen it.
Hundreds of, you're very chilling. It's very instructive. And I'm going to put this in an essay soon, because, people, you tend to think the situation is hopeless. But if you see that last speech, he's in the square. There's hundreds of thousands of people cheering for him, like they always did. And then a group of people in the crowd start jeering. which was a great act of courage because there's always secret police in the crowd. And then the jeers start to spread. This time the jeers start to spread. And all of a sudden, about halfway through the speech, the whole crowd is booing him and jeering him. And he's on the podium still, and he has no idea what's going on. You know, he thought he was in charge, you know, he was in your control. And three days later, I think he was dead. I don't remember if he was shot by his own people.
Yeah, by his own people.
He was shot.
I hadn't seen the speech, but I knew that story. And it is encouraging, minus the fact that, you know, not to call for violence, but I mean, it's encouraging that if there's enough of a shift in maybe the popularity of a politician. Like, have you seen in Austria, the chancellor who was just put into power there, as he was during that ceremony, he was walking through the crowds and everybody was booing him. Have you seen that?
Yeah, yeah. I haven't not, but you know, after this call, I'm going to go online to see it. I have not seen it because it fits some essays that I have in the queue, you know, to write. So I have to see that. Yeah. People feel you're powerless, but they're not powerless because everybody can change their own mind, you know. And as soon as they start to, you know, kind of change their own mind, it doesn't mean that everybody has to change their mind. It just means, you know, economists think on the margin, right? So just imagine the power of 10% of the population who currently has NPR syndrome. Just imagine if you had 10% of those who have NPR syndrome dropped it and started to think for themselves started to explore these issues. That's a seismic shift and would have a huge impact. And of course, it's been said, we get the politicians we all deserve. And it may not seem that way, but really. So as the internal nature of the population changes, so will the external changes. It is sad to see how far the United States has fallen. That, you know, people like Biden, Trump, Harris, you know, get the highest offices in the land, you know, people who are such shallow thinkers. Very few people in government know anything about the Constitution, you know, respect the Constitution. To them, it's a dead letter in comparison to the might of their plans. So we are heading towards authoritarianism, and it's going to accelerate when the stock market falls. I mean, I can't predict to you when the stock market is going to turn over, but it's going to turn over. The Fed at some point is going to be out of bullets, and the stock market is going to turn, and it's going to turn severely. I don't offer any forecast on 2022, 2023, 50% drop, 40% drop, 70% drop. Who knows? But it's coming. A major bear market will come. And you can imagine the level of societal fear that'll be out there for politicians to exploit. Authoritarian politicians will have a level of societal fear that they will be able to draw on. So it's incumbent that people do the work that I've been, talking about, writing about, because if we don't, it's guaranteed there will be some authoritarian who will make Biden or Trump, look like a schoolboy, and who will exploit what's in the population. So I shudder to think. I don't know if it's going to come on the right or the left, but it's coming if people don't start doing their inner work.
Well, I think that that's a sobering message and a very, very significant one. I wonder how you would suggest that individuals can help to change the critical mass. We've spoken about that a bit yesterday, like how big is the critical mass? What does it need to be? What can one person do? You're talking about self-growth, but some people might say, yeah, but you know, if, you know, knowing myself or understanding myself, I don't think that that's enough. It's just me against all of these big guys. You know, what can that really change?
Yeah. Well, yeah. And you're right. Just, you know, getting out the big guys, for instance, won't do anything. They'll just be another big guy to, you know, take their place. So if Fauci and all of his henchmen all left, you know, tomorrow, there'd be 500 new Faucis. If, you know, Bill Gates was off the scene of influence, there'd be another one to take their place. It's,
yes,
you know, people, when they shift their, you know, mindset, there'll be no demand for those services. I used to say this to you people, you know, there were, you know, potential Hitlers in the United States in the 30s that, you know, we've never heard about. There was no demand for their services. So they may have been some bum on the subway just muttering, you know, to themselves, because there was no demand for their, you know, services. So
yes,
we never heard about them. So yes, the fact that we have such poor leadership is simply because there is a demand for their services. So the power of the individual is very much larger than, you know, people think. It's, I know, you know, some people, you know, can't do much. They're scared of losing their job, and they have families, and they have a, you know, mortgage, and I, you know, respect that. But they can at least stop calling other people names. They can at least don't buy into, they could stop, you know, projecting. So if they have, you know, decided that for their family, you know, vaccination is best, all power to them. It's a fine choice for, you know, many people. But stop calling people who have made other choices names, okay? Then there will be no demand for politicians who call other people's names. You know, how could they be elected? How could they stay in office if the population thinks that is, you know, repugnant behavior? So it does all come back to the individual and having, you know, respect for other people and stop seeing people as it's, right?
Yes. Thank you for outlining that. I think that it's a very, very important message, and it needs to be repeated. There's also that book that I was speaking with you about called The Undiscovered Self by Carl Jung. And essentially what he was saying is what you're saying, that if you have a societal kind of crisis and you have people who do not know themselves, who do not self-study, who are not self-aware, then you will end up with them turning to a centralized religion, and with the lack of God thrown in there, you know, the God-shaped hole, that religion becomes the state, and it becomes the secular religion, and people worship the state. And so the antidote to that for him, and he was writing this post-World War II in the 50s, was to know yourself. And I think in knowing yourself, that also becomes contagious to the people around you, because your relationships change as well. And then if people want to stay within your sphere, then they also have to be more self-aware. And so you end up having this kind of groundswell of people who over a long period of time will maybe improve. And then your culture starts to change, and then your politics start to change.
Right. Right. Absolutely. I couldn't have said it any better. So, you know, thank you for sharing that, because that's very, you know, you're beautiful and insightful and hopeful, because it gives us a, you know, pass forward. And it is really the only, you know, true lasting pass for change. So there is no other way. There actually is no other way. Your people want shortcuts. Well, you know, this is the shortest cut we can give them, because, you know, changing your mind can be done in a second. Usually it's a process and involves study and practice. But it's in the power of the individual. So it's a very hopeful message, you know, that you shared. And it's the only real hope right now that all of us have. So it is our civic, you know, duty, you know, so to speak, to engage in such a process. It's our, you know, moral duty too, isn't it? It is really a moral, you know, duty too, because if we care about humanity, if we care about avoiding the worst, which is a very good possibility that we will have the worst. And if we at all care about avoiding the worst, my God, be comfortable sitting quietly and sitting at the feet of your own life and just learning from it each day. Shut off the television. Shut off your phone. Study, learn, learn about what's going on inside yourself. Stop your projecting, and maybe the worst can be avoided.
I think that is so beautiful, and I think that this is a great place to wrap up our discussion, the message of hope. I thank you so much, Barry, for being here with me today, and I hope that we can have a discussion like this again in the near future.
Yes, I enjoyed it a great deal. Thank you. I value your work, and I hope to come on again soon. So, you know, thank you very much.
Likewise, I hope that this will inspire some essays that I can get my hands on soon.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's guaranteed.
Yes. And I encourage everybody read your work. It's quite touching and it really speaks to my soul. And I think that other people will find the same. So thank you again.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. And anybody who's interested in getting all my essays in your box, just go to, you know, mindsetshifts.com. Mindsetshifts.com. Enter your email, and all my, you know, future essays will come straight to your email box.
Excellent. Thank you so much.